This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It is the kind of tragedy that might seem unthinkable in the U.S. 43 college students disappeared, shot by police or state troopers or maybe even the military, possibly even burned to hide the evidence. But it happened in Iguala, Mexico, back in 2014, to a group of student activists who were working to help farm workers. And as fate would have it, they were heading to an event commemorating another student massacre. Some of what happened to them was captured on video, with seemingly never-ending bursts of gunfire. The murders and disappearances shocked Mexico, and its citizens rose up in protest. What really happened on that night in 2014? How much was the government involved? Or maybe in the pocket of local drug gangs? And what's happening now to get justice for those 43 students? Joining us from Mexico City is Andalucia Noel Soloff, a journalist who has closely followed and reported on the events that took place in Iguala. Andalucia, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me on the show today.
Also joining us from Mexico City is Maria Luisa Aguilar Rodriguez, a human rights activist and advocacy team of Miguel Agustin Pro Juarez Human Rights Center that legally represents the families of the missing students. Maria Luisa, welcome.
Hello, Joshua. Thank you for having us.
Andalucia, tell us a little bit about the university that these 43 students attended, Ayotzinapa University. What kind of school is that, and what kind of students does it attract?
Yes, Ayotzinapa is a rural teachers' college. It's what's known as a normal school, which is actually a global concept of a school where people go to study and become teachers. All of Ayotzinapa's students actually come from rural areas of the state of Guerrero, which is in southern Mexico and is one of Mexico's poorest states and also has a large indigenous population. And all of the students come from rural communities and also many come from indigenous communities. And they go to this school to train to become teachers and then return to their communities or communities like the ones they come from that are often isolated. Sometimes there's not even phone service or internet or electricity, and they are elementary school teachers and often bilingual, as in Spanish and an indigenous language, in these rural communities. And the school has been around for 90 years, and it was actually born out of the Mexican Revolution when there were over 60 schools that were similar to Ayotzinapa, focused on educating Mexico's rural poor. Now there are only 16 of them, and they are all part of a federal association of rural farming and socialist schools, and it is driven by an activist socialist philosophy, and they're continually fighting to be in existence because the government has continually wanted to shut down these normal schools.
So this is just by way of the geography for people who aren't real familiar with Mexico's geography. So Iguala in the state of Guerrero, which is in Mexico, it looks like it's about, just looking at it on the map, about halfway from Mexico City south to Acapulco in a very kind of remote area. I wonder, Maria Luisa, if you can describe Iguala and the state of Guerrero and some of what's going on there, particularly with drug gangs who factor kind of prominently into this story.
Yeah, well, Guerrero has a history of a lot of violence since the 60s. A lot of violence on one side committed by the state itself. So also Guerrero, it's well known because it was one of the center where the Dirty War happened in the 60s. And at the moment, it's also one of the states where most of the poppy produced in Mexico, it's done. So Iguala, it's one of the center of these economics of criminal gangs that produce either poppy or other substances, and also control a lot of the region in collusion with the state authorities. And that's very important because what happened during that night was obviously part of this violence that leaves the state of Guerrero, but it was also perpetrated by state authorities and allowed by other state authorities.
Andalucia, break down for us what happened on that night. Let's back up a step before the violence happened. So you have these students from Ayotzinapa. There weren't just 43 of them, but there was this group of students. Where were they headed? Why were they heading there? Talk us through what was happening before the violence broke out.
Sure. So Ayotzinapa, as I mentioned, has a long history of social struggle, and Mexico has a long history of violence against students. And in 1968, there was the Tlatelolco student massacre that happened right before the Olympics were going to occur in Mexico City. It is unknown how many hundreds of students were killed during a student protest in Mexico City. And every year this happened on October 2nd, 1968. And every year, thousands of people come out and march and protest to commemorate this massacre. So the Ayotzinapa students had ironically wanted to travel to Mexico City to participate in this protest, as they do every year. As I mentioned, the government is continually wanting to shut down the Ayotzinapa school, and it is very underfunded. And part of this underfunding means that they don't have really their own transportation, and so they have this kind of agreement with many of the commercial bus companies in the state of Guerrero, where they do this thing where they commandeer buses, and the companies more or less allow them to use the buses for a few days and then return them, and they actually send them with a driver. So the students were organizing to go to travel 4 hours to Mexico City to go to a protest that would be in the following days. This happened on September 26th. The protest was going to be on October 2nd. And they had traveled to Iguala to go and see if they could commandeer some of the buses. But what happened was, and it's normally, well, it might sound very crazy, I think, especially for U.S. audiences, that students just go and somewhat take control of commercial buses.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Like, did they just stop the buses in the middle of the street or what?
They sometimes do just stop the buses at the toll booths, or actually just go to the station and negotiate with the drivers or the owners. But without going into, I think what's important is, while it does sound very crazy, it's important to recognize that it was a normal tactic that they used for decades even. And so therefore, the government at some point has tried to say that the violence was related to them taking the buses, but many human rights organizations have documented that that is not the case, because this really was normal activity that they would do over the past, decades. Anyway, so they were traveling. It was a group of about 100 students, and many of them were first-year students. They were freshmen that had just arrived at the school a few weeks before. This was going to be one of their first activities, and they went to the city of Iguala to see if they could get some buses that they would then use to go to Mexico City. They had some trouble getting buses at one of the toll booths. They ended up going to the bus station. And then there was more complications of that they didn't want to let them get the buses, et cetera. But they finally were able to leave Iguala, the group of 100 students, and they were on 5 different buses. Mm-hmm. The buses took different routes as they were leaving the city, and 3 of the buses went through the center of the city of Iguala. And as it was leaving, police closed off the road that they were driving on and then started firing. The students said, I've interviewed many of the students who were survivors of this attack, and they said that they heard the gunshots, but they never dreamed that they were shooting at them. They thought it was, some other occurrence that was happening. And so they opened fire on them, and then the students were unarmed. Many of the students, especially the ones that were some of the older students that were accompanying the freshmen, got off and tried to see if they could get the push. There was a police patrol that was blocking the buses. They tried to push the police patrol out of the way, because there was no policeman in it, and they wouldn't let them get through. And then they opened fire more, and one student actually, Aldo Gutierrez, he was shot in the head. He is, to the date, still in a coma. So that is over 3 years later. He is still in a coma. And the students really realized that why the police were going after them. And then at some point, they took all of the students that were on the third bus, since these were the 3 buses together. They took all the students off the third bus and detained those students.
Let me hold you right there, Andalusia. Yeah. Let me hold you right there, Andalusia. I want to get more into the narrative of what happened, as well as from the students' perspective, as we continue our conversation with Andalusia Noel Soloff and Maria Luisa Aguilar Rodriguez, speaking about these 43 students. We welcome your questions and thoughts as well, 1A@WAMU.org. Or if you are involved in some of the activism surrounding these 43 students, we would love to hear what has been going on from your perspective, or how you've been involved in trying to get more answers and accountability for these 43 students. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. Let's add one more voice to our conversation. Joining us from El Paso, Texas, is John Gibler, the author of I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us, an oral history of the attacks against the students of Ayotzinapa. John, welcome to 1A.
Hello, Duster. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you pick up the story where Andalusia had been telling it from the perspective of the students? Your book is an oral collection, basically an oral history collection, from the survivors of these attacks. Give us a sense of what the students described to you, other than pure shock at the gunfire, when this whole situation went down. Is this the kind of thing that they had braced themselves for? Was this a possibility they knew could occur, or did this completely catch them by surprise?
It completely caught them by surprise, and there was a precise moment of transition for them, which Andalusia already mentioned, which is the moment when the police shot Aldo Gutierrez in the head. The survivors told me that that was the moment when all of what they thought were the established rules of their engagements with police were shattered. Because as you know, you guys had already been talking about, they have a long history of activism, and sometimes the activism gets heated with the police, and they'll throw rocks, and the police will sometimes grab them and beat them up. A few years ago, in fact, state police had murdered two students during a protest in December 2011. So there were certain rules of engagement that they would fight with the cops, and the cops, if they got them, would beat them up. But then those rules of engagement, they said, were shattered when Aldo Gutierrez was shot in the head. And then from that point on, there was no possibility of dialogue. The students at several moments tried to surrender. And the police just shot at them every time they tried to come out from their hiding places, either inside some of the buses or between the parked buses, while police at the back of this one scene of attack, or two principal scenes of attack. This is the corner of Periférico and Juan N. Álvarez in Iguala, where the third bus on that attack, all the students but one were forcibly disappeared by the police at that moment. They were forced into official patrol trucks. There's one student who was shot in the arm, and a police officer, after submitting all the students and lying them down on the ground, put his rifle barrel to the student's head and said, "And what if I kill him?" But then that same officer took out a cell phone and called an ambulance, and later took that wounded student to an ambulance, and that student survived, and he is our sole surviving direct witness from that particular scene where the rest of the students were forcibly disappeared. And then there was a whole nother attack. Two other buses had taken a different route to get outside of town, and one of them was attacked directly in front of the state courthouse, a fact which becomes key because the state courthouse video surveillance equipment filmed these attacks, but then the state courthouse director said that she saw nothing of legal value in that in that video footage and destroyed it. But that one bus of students was entirely disappeared right in front of the state courthouse, John, simultaneously.
John Gibler, I wonder if you could give us some perspective for how we as Americans should be thinking through this. I mean, there's a lot baked into the U.S. relationship with Mexico, especially right now with talk about immigration, building the wall, and so on. I think for the average person, this may sound absolutely horrific, but as the average American, I'm not sure how to place this compared to immigration, the wall, all these larger issues. What do you think people who are hearing this story for the first time, John, should be keeping in mind about how this actually directly impacts us? Other than just the humanitarian, oh, isn't this awful piece? Yeah, I know. But why should America be concerned about this? Why should we care?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and I'd have three quick responses. One is, as you said, we should care because we should care about people, right, wherever they are and whatever the situation, I think. And then two, the merger of law enforcement and organized crime that has taken place over the past decade in Mexico, and I use that term very conscientiously merger, thinking in terms of economics. These are two businesses, the cops and the so-called criminals. They have fully merged, and it's that merger that allows atrocities of this nature, such as the mass forced disappearance of the students. And that merger has been entirely structured and made possible by the United States designed and imposed so-called drug war. That's number two. And also related to NAFTA and to immigration policies, a whole package of what I think are really neo-imperialist U.S. policies toward Mexico and across Latin America. And then also a third, because I don't think what's happening in relation to drug war violence, or so-called drug war violence in Mexico, is that different than violence that the United States unleashes directly, both in other countries and inside its own borders. And I think if we start with what happens on the streets and then how the law responds to that, we would see more similarities than disparities between, say, the Iraq War and Ayotzinapa than we probably care to admit.
Maria Luisa, I know we have to pause in just a moment, but I wonder if we could get a little bit deeper into this idea of being disappeared. I wonder if you could talk briefly about what it is about this that makes it so horrifying and the difficulties it creates in terms of getting accountability. I imagine that part of the challenge is just that it is so vague and it could mean anything. When we talk about being disappeared, what's in that idea? What are we talking about briefly?
Yeah, well, we're talking about people who were taken by state authorities because both of the groups of students that were disappeared were actually detained by state authorities, so they weren't forcibly disappeared. And then we have a pact of silence. So nobody actually gives any information, clear information, or nobody who was involved in the detentions and all that about what happened after that. And so the families just remain in a complete lack of information, or in this case, for example, well, after 3 years, we have a lot of different versions and informations. They have just a lot of things that cannot be proven. So what happened with people who are disappeared is that families remain in a state of, with no
uncertainty.
Thank you. Right. That they don't have the certain of what happened to their families,
right,
what happened to their relatives, and that it gives you more concern that actually that knowing what happened or that either somebody
right.
was in jail.
Maria Luisa, I'm really sorry to cut you short. We're up against a break. Hold that thought. I will let you continue your thought in just a moment. Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with a program we're working on about the civil rights movement. Every generation has their crusaders, the big names we know, and untold thousands whose support makes these movements possible. If you are active in civil rights, what or who are you fighting for? Are you part of a new generation of activists, or are you passing the torch? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. And here's why we want to hear from you. How are you doing in staying in this fight? Is burnout setting in? Tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. 855-236-1212. And we will share some of your stories soon on 1A. Back to our conversation with John Gibler, Andalusia Noel Soloff, and Maria Luisa Aguilar Rodriguez. We would love to hear from you. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. John Gibler, I'm sorry, Maria Luisa, I told you I would let you finish your thought. Go ahead and finish that thought, and then John, I'll come to you.
Yeah, maybe just to mention that this is not a story of pain of only 43 students or families. This is a story in Mexico of more than 32,000 families. Officially recognized, the Mexican government says that there are 32,000 people disappeared in Mexico in the last decade. or 11 years now. So, this concept of disappearances has touched a lot of families in this country, and it comes also for a lot of time where crimes committed in the 60s and 70s were not actually prosecuted and sanctioned. So disappearances in Mexico are a key issue to understand what is happening to the society. Just to mention that.
John Gibler, let's talk about some of the aftermath of this. The students told you after that first round of attacks by the police, they began trying to preserve evidence at the scene of this shooting, which I think kind of speaks to their lack of faith that law enforcement and the officials would do that properly. Talk about the initial response to the shooting, particularly what the students did to try to ensure justice for themselves.
Absolutely. I think this is really important. The students, and again, we're at the scene on the streets of Periférico and Juan de Álvarez in Iguala. After police forcibly submitted about 20-something students from that third bus and drove off with them in their patrol trucks, one police officer threatened the remaining students there, and some 30 or so, that they needed to get in their buses and go away and pretend like nothing happened. And those students said, "We're not going to do that because you've just, you know, arrested." They thought they were being arrested and not disappeared, but you've just arrested our colleagues, our friends, and you also shot one of our friends in the head, and so we're staying here. The police warned them. They said, "If you stay here, you regret it for the rest of your lives because we'll come back for you." The police then left, and the students had called the press. They'd called teachers in the Guerrero State Teachers Union that were friends of the school. They'd called also their classmates back at the school. And this is really key because two things. One, the students whom the mass media and the government criminalize, call vandals and call radicals, they were the only ones that night who actually behaved as if a rule of law existed. They looked at that scene, that street, and they thought in legal terms. They saw a crime scene and they saw evidence, as you said. So the bullet shells and bullet casings on the street, the pools of blood, the shirt used to wrap around Aldo's head to try and stop the bleeding, a finger, one shooting bid shot in the hand and one of his fingers was blown off. All of this the students saw in legal terms as evidence. And so they organized to protect that. They put rocks in big circles around the bullet casing so no one would touch them and contaminate the evidence, same with the blood. And they called the press. They called their colleagues. And over a period of about an hour, almost an hour and a half, people arrived from all over the state. But who arrived? Teachers, journalists, and other students. Not a single government official arrived to this mass scene of shootings to carry out their supposed legal duties of investigation and so forth. Instead, as the students had organized to protect this crime scene and were giving an impromptu press conference to six local journalists who had arrived, ununiformed, armed, and masked men arrived and opened fire directly on the press conference, in that moment murdering two students. And at that moment, a third student was last seen running from the gunmen. That student, Julio César Mondragón Fontes, was found tortured and murdered and mutilated a few blocks away the next morning.
What about the Andalusia? What about the Mexican government's response to all of this? Was there an official line from the government about what happened, who was responsible?
Yes. Well, their first, as John mentioned, their initial reaction was essentially to do nothing. And I think it's really important to understand how is it that over 32,000 people are disappeared. It means that their cases are never investigated. The first 24 hours and even 48 hours are essential in looking for disappeared people. So if these five buses were attacked and dozens of students were detained by the police and then taken somewhere, it had to be that all of the authorities were turning a blind eye to not follow the students and find out what happened to them. So disappeared, it has always includes the complicity of a government to not investigate what happens with the person at the moment, whether it is a member of an organized crime group or whether it is security forces. It means that they are not investigating and following what's happening in real time. Later on, the government first said that it was just kind of a bad apples, that there were local, the municipal police were involved with a local drug cartel, the Guerreros Unidos, and that they were the ones who kidnapped the students. Then it came out later that the mayor and his wife were involved and who are currently detained but not sentenced, even though 3 years have passed. And there are over 130 police who have been arrested, and 3 years have gone by, and they also do not have sentences. But the Mexican government, as a protest started growing, the family members organized, the students organized, and really they got the support of civil society. The government realized that they needed to respond more to what was happening, and maybe it wasn't just enough to say that it was this local criminal group, and they also needed to find the students. So what they said was, on November 7th, the Attorney General, Jesus Murillo Caram, said that the students were all burned to death in a garbage dump in the city or in the town of Cucula, which is near Iguala, that the criminal groups had brought them there and then dumped the bodies in a garbage dump and burned them. Many scientists and also other human rights experts have refuted this theory, saying that it is not scientifically possible that they would be burned there, and there was no evidence. And the government said this was just based on testimonies from some of the members of the organized crime of the 130 that I mentioned. It's not all police. It's also members of organized crime. Mm-hmm. That they had said that they gave testimonies that they brought the students there. But then also human rights organizations have denounced that it is possible that these testimonies were only acquired through torture. So they are not even legitimate testimonies. And the government essentially tried to close the case, saying that all of the students were murdered. And then in December, they presented evidence, DNA evidence of Alexander Mora Venancio, which has been confirmed by independent forensics, saying that they found his remains and that they have been identified as one of the 43 students, which lets them prove that all of the students were killed there, while independent forensics and human rights groups say that that is not proof because it's only one person and there is no other proof that he was killed there in that garbage dump.
Maria Luisa, I wonder if you could talk about what kind of motivated so many people to activism as a result of this. As I understand it, you know, more than 30,000 people have gone missing in Mexico in the last decade. People took to the street to protest after the government's delayed response to this. What was it about the incident in Iguala specifically that led to such an uprising? It seems that this incident prompted activism in a way that is kind of unique, hasn't it?
Yeah, it was an outcry after these events, and I think it's for many different reasons. Obviously, the main one is because of the strength of the students and the families, because they were, from the first day, doing demonstrations, demanding justice, demanding that the authorities go out and actually search for this for their colleagues and their children. So that's the main one. The second one is that at the time there was a large movement of students in Mexico City for other different reasons, but that was also kind of combined, and people could see each other in the students that were part of that. And I think that the other part is that it was so obvious that the authorities were involved in this case, and it was documented. I mean, people were actually acknowledging the federal government said this is only a local issue, but it was so obvious that this is not something that just happens during one night and that can be only arranged by a couple of policemen, that local policemen. So all that was a cry for just trying to do something new and trying to say that it was enough.
Jessica tweeted, Americans have a vested interest in stopping state-sponsored violence against civilians in Mexico, considering our government sends millions of dollars in the form of the Merida Initiative. That's a partnership between the U.S. and Mexico to fight organized crime and violence. Congress has put about $2.5 billion into that since 2008, and a big part of that is anti-corruption programs to vet police personnel. John Gibler, I wonder if you could respond to Jessica's tweet, particularly the aspect of state-sponsored violence. I wonder if the Iguala incident is considered state-sponsored violence in that they were complicit in the shooting itself, or that critics say that the state was complicit in allowing this to go unredressed for so long.
Absolutely. I think, first off, that Jessica's wise to point out the Merida Initiative, but the Merida Initiative is really just one small piece of a much broader package of laws of direct economic support that we could clumsily refer to as the U.S. designed and supported drug war. But the Merida Initiative is very concrete and direct. And again, they had supposed clauses in that initiative that if the security forces were involved in human rights abuses, then they would withhold some measly 15%, which even that they haven't done. But onto this question of state violence, I think this is key. The events in Ayotzinapa, and I think this also touches on your question about why it set off such outrage and activism, because they revealed a pre-existing state of state terror, not just state violence, but state terror. What the events in Iguala revealed was that the police forces were themselves organized crime. They were the people who controlled the kidnapping and extortion industries locally, and who had used the forced disappearance tactic of violence that comes from military dictatorships over the last 50 years, evolved in Argentina and Brazil and Uruguay and Chile, and also in Mexico, of course, but used now in a mercantile sense, like used to make money. It's easier for them to kidnap, get a ransom or part of the ransom, and then just murder and bury the body than to give the person back. And it was actually the police controlling this. And then with these particular events, the dimension of state complicity isn't just in, you know, first off, that the police were the ones shooting, murdering, and disappearing, and not just a couple of cops, but more than 150 police from three levels of government, three different cities, police, and federal police. But also, it's not just a cover-up. I think that the lies and the false evidence and the destruction of evidence constitute the atrocity itself. They constitute the continuation of the forced disappearance because they aren't looking for the students. And in fact, they're doing everything they can to make it impossible to find them. But also, and this is particularly painful, I think, they constitute torture. They're literally torturing the families who are looking for their children, and their government is telling them your sons were incinerated, not just burned, but incinerated, reduced to ash, where there's not even a DNA trace, in an open air trash dump during a rainstorm.
I know we're low on time, but we wanted to play a statement from Coyuco Barrientos, who is a student and survivor of the attacks in Iguala. It's in Spanish. We'll translate it after we play it. It's very brief. Listen.
Hay una frase que muchos dicen aquí. Quien ve una injusticia y no la combate, la comete.
The phrase means whoever sees an act of injustice and does not combat it, commits it. I wonder if maybe that's a place, as we have to wrap up our conversation, Andalusia, to come to you. I mean, we've heard about this. I'm not sure what I, as an American, can do to help combat this. What do you want people to do? And I'd like to hear from Maria Luisa also, very, very briefly, Andalusia. For people who hear this and they're moved, what should they do?
Well, I think a really important thing that's happening with the show is that people are still talking about it. I think that the government, with saying that the students were all burned to death, they have very successfully convinced people both in Mexico and also the United States that all the students are dead. There's nothing more to know about the case. There's nothing to investigate. It's a it's closed case. And I think one of the first things that people need to do is talk about it. It's still 3 years later, and the students, they have neither been found alive nor found dead. No one knows their whereabouts, and also that put pressure that it keeps being investigated. The more that people talk about it, the United States, as John mentioned, has an obligation to, if they continue relationships with Mexico, Mexico has to respect human rights, which Mexico has not been doing and has been an actor of state violence. So I think the more people put pressure on their local government, their federal government, to care about what is happening with Mexico and to oblige what is legally that they should, they cannot support and do trade and all the business they do with Mexico if Mexico is violating the human rights of their own citizens. So I think a first step is actually just talking about it and that this is not a case that should be forgotten. And also perhaps making links. I know that many people, when the movement was active, made links to Black Lives Matter with police opening fire. So, you know, seeing how it could relate to their own lives in the U.S.
Andalusia Noel Soloff, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me on.
Maria Luisa Aguilar Rodriguez, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
I'm sorry, Maria Luisa, we're out of time. I wish we had more time to continue the discussion, but we appreciate you being on. And John Gibler, author of I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us. Thanks, John, for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Joshua.
Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.